From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Fifth Stair. One morning early in the 1900s, Guy Vance, a freelance journalist, inquired at the office of Bain, Pell & Company, Kensington, if they knew of any small house in the southwest district of London that was to be let unfurnished at a moderate rental. "There is one in Rickett Road," Mr. Pell told him. "It is a two-story house, and the rent is only £50 a year." "That is certainly moderate," Vance said. "Why is the rent so low? Is anything wrong with it? Drainage? Dampness? Cracks in the walls due to settlement?" Mr. Pell shook his head. "No, sir, there's nothing wrong with it. The last tenants remained in it for the full term of their 7-year lease." "When can I view it?" Vance asked. "Any time you like," Mr. Pell replied. Accompanied by one of the estate agent's clerks, Vance went to number 13 Rickett Road, Kensington, the next day and liked the house so much that he took it for 3 years, with the option of remaining in it for another 3 years at the same rental. He engaged Mrs. Camp, a middle-aged woman, as his housekeeper, and Emma Larkin, a younger woman, as a general servant. They slept in the house. Jane Bolt, a girl of about 20 years of age, was a daily. The household was completed by Pop, a bull terrier, and Eve, a gray cat. It was not until Vance had been in the house several weeks that things began to happen. He was in his sitting room, writing one evening, when Pop growled and ran to the door, his hair bristling. Puzzled at the dog's odd behavior, Vance opened the door and saw a strange woman in black emerge from a cupboard under the stairs, cross the little hall and enter the kitchen. He could only get a side view of the woman, and what he saw of her face startled him. It was so white. Wondering who she was, he went to the kitchen, only Mrs. Camp was there. She was getting his supper, as it was Emma Larkin's night out. Mrs. Camp stared in astonishment when Vance asked where the strange woman had gone. "What strange woman?" she queried. "Why, the one who entered the kitchen just now," Vance replied. "You must be dreaming, Mr. Vance," Mrs. Camp said. "No one has been here." It was Vance's turn to stare at her. "I most distinctly saw a woman in black with a very white face come out of the staircase cupboard and come in here," he said. He told Mrs. Camp about Pop. They were both mystified, but that was only the beginning of the disturbing happenings. The following day, Mrs. Camp, going upstairs, had reached the fifth stair, which was directly above the cupboard, when she was suddenly overcome with the utmost horror. She felt there was something very dreadful underneath her. She was a strong-minded, practical woman, very skeptical regarding the supernatural, but it was only with the greatest effort that she pulled herself together and went on upstairs. She did not say anything about it to Vance and tried to persuade herself that her spell of horror had been due to imagination. Pop showed a strong aversion to going up the staircase, and it was noticed that Eve confined herself apparently to the ground floor. Some days passed, then one morning Emma Larkin ran screaming into the kitchen, sank into a chair, and had hysterics. When she had recovered sufficiently, she said that when she was going up the staircase to make the beds, something heavy whizzed through the air past her and fell with a thud in the hall. She did not see anything, but she felt most acutely that it was very ghastly and horrible. Mrs. Camp did her best to calm and assure her that it was just her fancy, but Emma declared she could not stay in the house an hour longer and left. That evening, about 9 o'clock, Vance was in the sitting room reading by the fire. Mrs. Camp was out, and he was alone in the house. Everywhere was still except for the ticking of the clock in the hall and the pattering of heavy raindrops on the window panes. Suddenly the hush was broken by a scream, so piercing and full of terror that Vance was appalled. It was followed by a heavy thud. Vance nerved himself to open the door, but nothing was to be seen, nothing to account for the sounds. He shut the door and returned to his seat by the fire, and was glad when Mrs. Camp returned. He decided that the house was badly haunted, especially the staircase. He had already made a note of the ghostly happenings and now added to this list the cry that he had just heard. The next day a new general servant, Mary Pring, took the place of Emma Larkin, and for a time all was quiet. Then, one day, about a week after Emma had left, Jane Bolt came to Mrs. Camp and said, "One of the rods in the staircase is out, and every time I try to put it back in, my fingers go numb. I can't manage it." Mrs. Camp went to the staircase. As her instinct had led her to expect, the stubborn rod was on the fifth stair, the very stair on which she had experienced the sudden wave of horror. She tried to put it back, but her fingers too became numb. Just then Vance, who heard her talking to Jane Bolt, opened the drawing room door and asked if there was anything the matter. The moment he spoke, Mrs. Camp's fingers ceased being numb, and she replaced the rod in its socket without any difficulty. Again there was a lull of several days, and Vance and Mrs. Camp were hoping that there would be no more disturbing happenings, when Mary Pring, looking very pale and scared, came to Mrs. Camp one morning and asked the name of the strange lady in black. "What strange lady?" Mrs. Camp inquired, not knowing what else to say. "Why, when I was about to go up the staircase just now," Mary said, "I got a bad start. I suddenly saw a rather tall woman with a very white face and forbidding expression coming down it. She was in a black dress. She passed by me, and when I looked to see where she went, she had vanished. I don't want to see her again." Mrs. Camp guessed that the woman who had startled Mary was a mysterious person in black that Vance declared he had seen cross the hall one evening and enter the kitchen. The housekeeper was not at all curious to see that woman, but she did. One evening, about a fortnight after Mary Pring's experience, Vance was talking to Mrs. Camp and Mary in the sitting room, the door of which was wide open, when he heard someone coming down the staircase. As there was no one in the house except the three of them, the day had left, they stared at one another, wondering who it could be. They then looked and saw crossing the hall a woman in black. She was clutching by its long gray hair with one hand a human head that appeared to have been just decapitated. Dangling from its ears were gleaming gold drop earrings. A weird light surrounded the woman and the head. The woman went to the cupboard under the stairs, turned slowly round, revealing a face that was the incarnation of everything bad, stepped into the cupboard, and abruptly vanished. The shock of what they had witnessed had been so great that it took Vance and the two women some moments before they could even partially recover. Mrs. Camp was the first to compose herself. Both she and Mary declared their inability to remain in the house any longer and left the next day. Vance, not caring to stay in the house alone, lest he should see the woman with a head again, or something even worse, put up at a hotel until he could find another house. Before he left the neighborhood, he made many inquiries and eventually learned that about 60 years before he went to number 13 Rickett Road, a dreadful murder had been committed there. A woman named Kate Murphy had murdered her mistress, Miss Delia Brown, an elderly spinster, in a manner too awful to describe, and after dismembering the body on the flat roof of the house, had distributed her remains in various parts of the district. Miss Brown's head was the only part of her body that was never found. The owner of 13 Rickett Road, after listening to Vance's account of the ghostly occurrences that he had experienced there, had the floor of the staircase cupboard excavated. Under it was a skull with long, matted gray hair. The doctor who examined it was of the opinion that it had been there for many years, so that although there was no actual clue regarding its identity, it seemed not unlikely that it was the missing head of poor murdered Miss Delia Brown. The Creeping Hand of Maida Vale. A somewhat impecunious family named Newman, attracted by the remarkably low rental of a house in Maida Vale, London, took it on a 3-year lease. They moved into it in December, and for the first few months of their tenancy, nothing occurred to suggest, even remotely, that the house was haunted. Then in March, shortly after the advent of Maisie Newman, a buxom girl of about 20 years of age, to take up her abode once more with her parents, things began to happen. Coming home one afternoon, Maisie went into a room in the basement to take off her boots, and while there suddenly saw an old woman wearing an old-fashioned black gown, a white cap, the somewhat crumpled border of which fit closely to her head, and a white handkerchief pinned across her bosom, standing in the doorway looking at her. Thinking it was either new servant or Daly, Maisie called out casually, "Here, Mary or Jane or whoever you are, take these boots like a deer and dry them for me." They were very high lace-ups, and Maisie tossed them carelessly one after the other at the old woman. To her unmitigated surprise and horror, the boots went right through the aged dame, who, in turning slowly round, disappeared in the gloom of the narrow stone pavement outside. As soon as she could pull herself together, Maisie ran upstairs, and meeting her mother in the hall, was explaining to her what had happened, when she suddenly stopped short, pointing excitedly at the staircase and exclaimed, "There she is! That is the woman!" Looking in the direction Maisie indicated, Mrs. Newman saw to her astonishment the figure Maisie had just described in the act of ascending the stairs. Remembering a test for hallucination that had been explained to her a short time before by a medical man, Mrs. Newman now quickly determined to try it. Pressing one eye so as to throw it out of parallel focus with the other, she stared hard at the figure, which immediately appeared double. Convinced now that what she saw was objective, for had it merely been the result of hallucination, it would have undergone no change from the test applied to it, Mrs. Newman at once proceeded to follow the figure upstairs. Moving absolutely noiselessly, it had gone about halfway up the second flight when it abruptly vanished, and Mrs. Newman and Maisie found themselves staring into empty space. This was the Newman's first experience with the unknown. The second occurred a few days later. Mr. Newman, who never finished in the city very early, and who had, as a rule, much correspondence to attend to when he got home, was in the habit of sitting up late, and on the night in question it was close on 12 before he put down his pen and rose to go to bed. Switching the light off and gently closing the study door, for everyone else had long since retired, he crossed the hall on tiptoe and began to ascend the stairs. The intense and unusual, so he thought, silence of the house struck him forcibly. The window on the landing overlooking the garden in the rear of the house was open, and the tapping of the ivy against the glass sounded so strangely loud that Mr. Newman was for a moment quite startled. He could almost have fancied it was someone outside rapping, and then a draught of cold air rustling past him set the shabby, weather-worn front door rattling on its hinges, and the rattling was so pronounced that it really seemed as if someone was turning the handle and trying to gain admittance. Step by step, Mr. Newman mounted the stairs. He had arrived in the middle step of the second flight, leading to the first floor, when he suddenly felt himself collide with something that was apparently obstructing his way. Wondering whether he was asleep or awake, he rubbed his eyes vigorously and again attempted to ascend. The same thing happened. He came right up against some invisible object, and this time he drew back with a violent shudder. He was still standing on the edge of the stairs, shivering and not knowing what to do, when something cold and clammy seemed to fasten round his throat, and in another instant he began to choke. He tried to free himself, but though he could distinctly feel the thing round his neck throttling him, he could grasp nothing with his fingers. He threw out his arms and beat the air wildly. He stamped on the ground and kicked, but it was of no avail. He could feel or touch nothing, and all the while the sensation of being strangled intensified more and more. At last, just as he was on the verge of losing consciousness, and the buzzing in his ears had developed into thunderclaps, a door from somewhere overhead opened, and a voice that might have come from several houses away, it seems so remote, called, "Father, Father, whatever is the matter?" In a moment, Mr. Newman experienced a great sensation of relief. The thing, whatever it was, relaxed its hold, and he was able once again to breathe freely. Up to that time, he had not felt as much actual fear as repugnance. There had been something in the touch that had repelled and shocked him. But now that it was gone, reaction set in, and Maisie, for it was she who had called out, found him standing on the stair, looking ghastly white and trembling. The next experience of the haunting concerned the Newman's tortoiseshell cat, which soon showed she was just as much in possession of the psychic sense as any dog or human. To begin with, although Julie, as the cat was called, was decidedly fond of wandering about the upper part of the house during the daytime, nothing would induce her to remain there after dark. The moment it began to grow dusk, she was invariably seen hurrying downstairs to the ground floor or kitchen, and no amount of coaxing would persuade her to go upstairs again till the following morning. Also, for no apparent reason, she would sometimes in the evening exhibit signs of panic, and if the door of the room she was in happened to be shut, she would climb frantically in her effort to get out. One day, early in April, Mr. Newman's married daughter, Violet, accompanied by her only child, Delia, came on a visit to the house. Like most children, Delia was very fond of playing with animals, and she soon struck up a friendship with Julie. One evening, shortly after tea, her mother, hearing a commotion in the breakfast room where she had left Delia playing with Julie, ran to see what was the matter. To her relief, Delia was all right, and on being asked what all the noise was about, replied, "Why, Julie has behaved so badly. I didn't know she was such a naughty, jealous old thing. While I was playing with her a few minutes ago, another animal came into the room and wanted to join in." "Another animal?" Delia's mother exclaimed in great astonishment. "What animal?" "Well, I don't exactly know what it was, Mummy," Delia replied, "for somehow I couldn't see it very plainly. It seemed to be all misty. But it wasn't a cat or a dog, for it had long, funny ears and moved about ever so fast. I tried to touch it, but it wouldn't let me, and it jumped about so I couldn't get very near it. Julie gave up playing with me the moment it appeared, and she kept scratching at the door so hard that I let her out, for I was afraid Granny would be angry. Just look at what the naughty thing did." And Delia pointed at the marks of Julie's claws on the door. "I see," her mother said, shaking her head severely. "But tell me, Delia, what happened to the animal you talk about? Where is it now?" "In that cupboard," Delia cried, pointing to a small cupboard near the fireplace. "It ran in there when I was chasing it. That is all that noise. And as soon as I had it nice and safe inside, I shut the door and bolted it." The child clapped her hands gleefully. "And it is there still?" her mother asked anxiously. "Oh, yes," Delia laughed. "It couldn't possibly get out. See?" And tiptoeing gently to the cupboard, she shot back the bolt and threw open the door. There was nothing whatever inside. The last experience the Newman family had with the unknown in this house occurred a night or two later. The married daughter, Violet, slept with Maisie in a room on the first floor. On this particular night, they both retired to bed somewhat earlier than usual. Maisie fell asleep almost as soon as her head touched the pillow, while Violet lay propped up with pillows, reading. At length, growing weary, she fell asleep too, but soon afterwards awoke suddenly and completely, with a vivid sense of some extra, unlooked-for presence in the room. She sat up hastily and looked at the candle. She had left it burning, and very little of it remained. Feeling extraordinarily awake, she took up her book and recommenced reading. By and by, however, the feeling that this extra unlooked-for presence was still in the room, close to her, grew so strong that she put down her book and glanced cautiously around. There was nothing and no one to be seen, saving Maisie, who lay sleeping peacefully by her side, and Delia, who was in a small bed beside them, also fast asleep. But still Violet was not satisfied. She felt unquestionably that there was an additional something or someone in the room with them. Peering round her furtively for the extraordinary stillness in the atmosphere generated fear, a fear to which she had hitherto been a total stranger. she suddenly received a shock. On the wall facing her, about midway between the floor and the ceiling, was a strange and sinister-looking shadow. It was the shadow of a hand, with fingers stretched out, as if in the act of clutching something. Violet moved her own hands at once, but that made no difference. The shadow still remained there. Then she shifted the pillow and various other objects around her, but the shadow still retained both its shape and position. Seized with a horrible fascination, she now sat bolt upright and stared at the hand. It did not seem somehow to be a man's hand. It was scarcely large enough. It was more like the hand of a coarsely made woman. The fingers were long, with bony protruding knuckles and very square tips. There were no rings on any of them, and the top of the little finger was missing. It was not merely an ugly hand, it was hideous and repellent. And Violet, as she sat staring at it, felt just the same feeling of loathing well up within her as she would have felt had she been staring at some venomous and repulsive insect. And now, to her horror, the shadow suddenly began to move. Rising slowly, it crept stealthily up the wall till it eventually reached the ceiling. There for a moment or two it paused, and then, with a furtive spider-like movement, it cautiously advanced over the ceiling, nearer and nearer to the bed, till it finally halted exactly over Maisie's head. A terrible fear now seized Violet. She tried to cry out, to utter any sound, but she could not. She was tongue-tied and helpless, and in this condition she was compelled to witness all that followed. She saw the shadow slowly leave the ceiling and descend the wall, always with the same horrible insect-like movement, till it came to about a level with Maisie's head. Then quite suddenly it vanished, and immediately afterwards Maisie moved, while an expression of fear speedily followed by one of loathing, which in its turn was supplanted by one of pain, convulsed her features. Violet, still unable to move a hand or foot or utter a sound, was now compelled to watch her sister undergoing physical as well as mental torture, for she appeared to be laboring for breath, precisely as if she was being very gradually but surely throttled. When she awoke, she told Violet that she had just had the most horrible dream. She had dreamed that someone had tried desperately hard to strangle her, and so realistic had it all been that she could still feel the fingers pressing with hideous ferocity on her windpipe. Violet then told Maisie about the hand, and for the rest of the night, the two sisters lay awake, talking with candles burning by the bedside. In the morning, they told their parents what had occurred and insisted on them leaving the house at once. Mr. Newman now thought it high time to make inquiries, and as on doing so he learned that the house had long borne a reputation for being haunted, he straightway interviewed the landlord, the interview resulting in his being let off the remainder of the lease on payment of what amounted to little more than a nominal sum. Mr. Newman made inquiries about the house but learned nothing more than that it had been rumored to be haunted for a long time, and that some very queer people were said to have once lived there. The Man on the Landing. A very strange case of complex hauntings occurred, and I believe even yet occurs, in a fine old country mansion once the home of the Ricard family near Weymouth. It is a queer, rambling building full of winding oak staircases and long, narrow corridors. Some of its windows look down on a gloomy courtyard and others on the even more gloomy burial ground of a very ancient church. Viewed in the daytime, even the atmosphere of the place impresses one with a sense of loneliness, and this sense deepens as the day progresses. After sunset, when the shadows from the great elms and firs clustering around the house darkens its walls and windows, the effect is ghostly in the extreme, and it would be a matter of positive surprise to a believer in the superphysical if the place did not contain a ghost. Actually, it is said to contain at least two. One of them appeared some years ago to a Mrs. Walters, who was on a visit to the then tenants of the house. Towards dusk one afternoon, Mrs. Walters left her children in the nursery to dress for dinner, and on the landing outside met her daughter-in-law, also a visitor. While they were standing talking, Mrs. Walters suddenly heard footsteps, and on looking down the staircase whence they came, she saw a tall man with iron-gray hair in the act of ascending. Struck with his appearance, for there was something strange about him, she watched him mount to the top of the stairs, and then crossed the landing some few yards from where they stood. Advancing towards a door leading into what was at one time an oratory, but which had for some years past served as a kind of a box room, he opened it very stealthily and entered, closing it gently. Convinced now that he was a thief, Mrs. Walters at once ran to the door and flung it open. To her amazement, however, no one was there. Around her lay a pile of trunks and miscellaneous pieces of furniture, but of the gray-haired man there was no trace. Mrs. Walters at once told her daughter-in-law what had happened, and asked if she could in any way account for it. To add to her mystification, however, her daughter-in-law denied ever having seen the gray-haired man, and tried to persuade her it was sheer imagination. They were still discussing the matter when their hostess, attracted by their voices, which was raised somewhat high, appeared on the scene, and on hearing Mrs. Walters' story at once exclaimed, "Why, that was the ghost!" She then went on to explain that the house was haunted by the ghost of an old man, popularly believed to have been murdered centuries ago, in a manner too horrible to describe. On another occasion, Sir C. T., the tenant of the house, entertained two judges who were on their way to the assizes at Dorchester. During the meal, one of the judges was very talkative and cheerful, while the other hardly said a word but sat wrapped in gloomy abstraction. Afterwards, when they were driving together to Weymouth Railway Station to catch the train for Dorchester, the gloomy judge suddenly observed to the cheerful one, "I say, do you know why I was so silent at dinner?" "No," said his friend. "Why?" "You will laugh at me, I dare say, when I tell you," replied the other. "It was because I saw standing behind our hostess' chair, all the time we were at the table, a figure that was the exact counterpart of herself." "Nonsense," laughed the cheerful judge. "It's as true as I'm sitting here," the gloomy judge said, "and you may depend upon it, we shall hear bad news of her before long." What he said proved only too true, for within 1 hour after they had left, Sir C.T.'s Lady T. retired to her own apartment and hanged herself. Still another haunting. One summer evening some years ago, two girls were standing at one of the windows of the old house, drinking in the sweet-scented air and admiring the effect of the soft white moonbeams on the beautiful old ivy-covered church that stood only a little distance from them. The night was very still, scarcely a whisper of the wind, nor a rustle of leaves, and in the fields that lay alongside the church, the cattle were standing dumb and motionless. Indeed, the only sign of life and movement were the bats, that whirled in noiseless flight in and out of the trees and bushes on the lawn. The girls, who had been silent for some minutes, were about to interchange remarks, when suddenly a bell began to toll. "Good heavens!" one of them exclaimed. "Why, that's the passing bell! Who can be dead?" "Does it never ring except on the occasion of a death?" said the other. "Why, no," her companion replied, "and I have never heard it so late at night as this before." There was something in the sound that fascinated them, and they stood listening till the bell at length ceased and silence once again reigned. Then they went to bed. In the morning, one of them, the daughter of the then tenant of the house, received a telegram saying that her grandfather, who lived in the country, but at some distance along the coast, had died suddenly, at the very time she and her friend both heard the passing bell. Much puzzled to know why it had rung, however, for it seemed hardly likely that the news of his death could have traveled so quickly, she went to the church and inquired of the sexton. "The passing bell?" he exclaimed, looking at her in amazement. "And of this church? Miss, you're mistaken. No one died in this village last night, and no bell rang." "Oh, but it did," the girl insisted, "for I and my friend both heard it. Someone must have gotten to the belfry." "Impossible," the sexton said emphatically, "for the key of it has never been out of my possession. No, not for an instant." Greatly mystified, the girl then inquired the vicar, and with the same result. No one had died in the village, he informed her, and no bell had tolled. And there the matter ended. To this day, a puzzle. The Ghosts of the Beeches. Major Horace Wyndham, retired, was looking for a house in the country. A firm of estate agents in Upper Norwood, to whom he went, gave him the names of a number of houses without success, as the rent was too high, or he did not like the situation, and he was beginning to despair when they at length found the Beeches in Lancashire, with a very low rental. The estate was within 30 miles of Manchester. Wyndham trained to Rington, the nearest station to the Beeches, and from there took a taxi to Saxby, a large village on the outskirts of which the Beeches lay. It was a building shaped like two unequal sides of a rectangle. The walls were overgrown with ivy, and tall trees sheltered it on either side. A winding carriage drive led up to the house, which was faced by a lawn, at the far side of which was a lake spanned by a long wooden bridge. The bridge had a curious fascination for Wyndham. He leaned over the railing on one side of it and peered into the water, wondering what secrets the dark depths might contain. The house was very old and had changed hands repeatedly. He liked it, and took it on a 3-year lease, returning to see the furniture moved in. His family, consisting of his wife, his son Robin, a cadet at Sandhurst, and his daughter Nora and Lillian, were to follow him in 2 days. After all the furniture had been assigned to their proper places and he had had supper, Wyndham sat for a time in front of a fire in the sitting room, and then went to his bedroom. Beside himself in the house there was Mrs. Bird, the cook, and Gertrude Wise, one of the maids. The rest of the servants were to come with the family. He thought as he sat before the fire prior to getting in between the sheets, how incongruous the furniture looked amid the old world settings, the oak paneling on the walls, the ingle, and the ancient cornices. He got out of his easy chair and was about to cross the floor when he stopped short and rubbed his eyes to make sure he was not dreaming. He was certain the pillow had been flat in the bed. Had it not been, he would have noticed it. But now it was upright and no longer smooth. Its shape was changing very gradually into the semblance of a face, the distorted face of a man, eyes staring, mouth gaping and distended. Wyndham went to the bed and put the pillow in its place. The desire to get into bed had now gone. He resumed his seat by the fire. The bed, however, had a strange fascination for him. He felt obliged to look at it. The bedclothes moved and seemed to be in a state of convulsion. Presently they rose pyramidically higher and higher and assumed a figure like that of a malformed person with the peak-shaped head. The now sinister-fashioned eyes suggested malicious amusement and the mouth leered mockingly. The size and malignity of the figure appalled Wyndham, and for some moments he sat petrified. At last, pulling himself together with an effort, he walked to the bed, and as he did so the figure subsided and the clothes fell into their proper place. "Absurd," Wyndham muttered. "Perfectly ridiculous. I must have been dreaming." But he knew it was no dream, and that there was something devilish funny about the bedstead. He did not relish the idea of sleeping in the dark, but forced himself to do so, and slept soundly till the morning. Nothing more of note occurred till after the family had moved in. Robin, who had finished his first term at Sandhurst, was the next to have an experience. He was approaching the lake one afternoon when he saw 2 men, one tall, the other short, on the bridge. The tall man suddenly caught hold of the other, and in spite of the smaller man's struggle, hurled him over the railings and into the lake. Full of anger at such a cowardly attack, Robin rushed to the bridge, but on reaching it saw no sign of the tall man. Yet he had been in the center of the bridge, and there was nowhere for him to hide. Robin then peered down into the dark water. It was perfectly calm and undisturbed, nothing to be seen of the short man. Completely mystified, he retraced his steps to the house, not mentioning the incident to anyone. It was Nora's turn next. She was in the orchard taking down apples one morning when someone touched her shoulder. She turned around and was not a little startled to see a tall, shrouded figure in black confronting her. It remained stationary for some moments and then, walking away, was lost to view among the trees. Hastening to the house, she told Lillian and Robin about the shrouded figure. Lillian laughed and said it must have been a monk from a neighboring monastery. Robin thought of the man he had seen on the bridge, but still said nothing. Mr. and Mrs. Wyndham occupied separate bedrooms close to one another. Mrs. Wyndham was preparing to undress one night when the shaking of the heavy curtains covering the oriel window made her look wonderingly at it. There was no wind. It was a very calm night. She was still gazing at the curtain when it bulged out as if someone was standing behind it. To utter a sound might make whoever was there emerge and attack her, so she stole as noiselessly as possible to the door, opened it, then sprang out to the landing and ran to her husband. He called Robin, and the two of them went into Mrs. Wyndham's room and searched everywhere. There was no trace of an intruder. The mystery of the bulging curtain remained unsolved. Then one of the maids told the cook that she had been awakened in the night by an icy hand on her forehead. She was so terrified that she buried her head under the clothes and did not stir till the morning. She said if it occurred again, she would leave. The butler told Wyndham in confidence that the house was haunted. He had seen a shrouded figure in black bending over him in the night. It had been a dreadful shock. But Lillian scoffed at the butler's account of his ghostly experience. It was a nightmare, she said. He had eaten too much at supper. He was a big eater. Lillian's room was isolated at the end of the corridor. She had just got into bed one night when she heard footsteps in the corridor. They halted at the door of her room, and through the closed and locked door something crawled in. It looked vaguely like a person on all fours, and yet there was a non-human element about it, a semi-animal appearance. It had a scaly body and bald, bulbous head. It came with a crab-like motion, stealthily towards her. Compelled by a force she could not resist, she sat up and watched the thing getting slowly nearer and nearer to her. Reaching the bed, it crawled, to her terror, under it, and she felt the bed heave up. Tumbling out of it, all her skepticism now gone, she rushed out of the room, down the corridor, and into Robin's room. He roused her father, and armed with revolvers, they went to Lillian's room, and not without some reluctance and apprehension, looked under the bed and searched everywhere. To their relief, there was no sign of the thing Lillian claimed to have seen. The Wyndhams were now in a very unsettled and perplexed state. They did not know what to do, stay or leave. Another ghostly happening furnished them with an answer. They were sitting in the hall shortly before supper one evening, when there were screams from the servants' quarter, and presently through the hall rushed the spectral form of a short man, his face convulsed with terror. Close on his heels came the figure of a tall man, holding what looked like a meat chopper or axe in one hand. A gruesome light surrounded both figures. They passed through the wall of the room opposite their entrance. Their exit was succeeded by the entrance in the body of the servants, who very excitedly informed Mrs. Wyndham that they could not stay another day in the house, as the house could not be managed without servants, and it was very doubtful if new ones would remain long. The Wyndhams were obliged to sacrifice money and leave. The estate agents who had obtained the house for them now admitted that they were not surprised at their departure, as no tenants had remained in it for long. According to a traditional local story, about 100 years ago a young brother had murdered his elder brother in the house in order to inherit a fortune, and had thrown the body into the lake. It was this diabolical murder that was supposed to furnish an explanation for the haunting of the Beeches by the phantom of the two brothers. But for an explanation of the other ghostly happenings, one would have to look much further back, probably to black magical rites and acts practiced on the site of the Beeches estate in very remote days.